I'm Lisa Heineman, co-host of New Books in Gender and Sexuality Studies, part of the New Books Network. Thanks for joining us today. When we hear the word eugenics, we often think of coercive programs, forced sterilization, for example. When we hear the words reproductive health, we often think about individual freedoms like access to contraceptives. Historian Annetta Timm shows us how these notions are intertwined, how healthy fertility can be at once a matter of sexual duty, as she calls it, a responsibility to the state, and something that individual citizens wish for their own personal happiness. Timm brings us this history in the case of the city of Berlin, which experienced a liberal administration in the aftermath of World War I, Nazi rule from 1933 to 45, foreign occupation, and finally division into communist and democratic sectors before reunification in 1990. In her book, The Politics of Fertility in 20th Century Berlin, which came out with Cambridge University Press in 2010, Timm shows us how the ideology of sexual duty evolved and eventually faded, and how it played itself out at the local level, which, after all, is where we get our health care. Annetta Timm is Associate Professor of History at the University of Calgary, and she joins us for today's podcast. Well, I'm really happy to have you on the show today. I'm thrilled to be talking about your book, The Politics of Fertility in 20th Century Berlin. But maybe before we get started with the book, tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you get into this line of work? What made you interested in working on fertility in 20th Century Berlin?
Well, the route is a little bit circuitous, I would say. I began in my interest in history in general because, literally, I sat around talking about history on Saturday mornings with my dad, who both my parents are from northern Germany. They came to Canada in 1954, so I'm an immigrant kid, and though I was born in Canada. And I heard a lot of stories about Germany during the war when my parents were children. My parents were 14 when the war ended. They were both in the Hitler Youth before the fall of the Third Reich. And so, you know, needless to say, as immigrants to Canada in their 20s, they had to tell a lot of stories about where they'd come from, and they told them to us. So I was always kind of fascinated by Germans of that generation and how they'd reacted to the war. And there was quite a large immigration to Canada of Germans who left Germany. So what led them to relinquish their allegiance to a country and you know, get on a ship and start a whole new life in a new country. So those things are why I became interested in German history. I think it was a fascination built into my family. But then when I started grad school, I didn't have specific ideas about what I was going to look at in particular. And I went to the University of Chicago. So I was a Canadian studying German history in Chicago just around the time of Bill Clinton's healthcare reform initiatives, and coming from a place where healthcare is virtually considered a right, going to a place where it isn't, I moved my interest towards issues of health. And then, you know, there was a movement from the dissertation to the book. The dissertation was more about healthcare and healthcare provision, and the book became more about history of sexuality. So that's another part of the story.
Very, very interesting. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, tell us a little bit about that, because, you know, this is, you know, when I read the book, we get a sense of sort of deep embeddedness in the world of health. But indeed, it turns out health intersects with sexuality all over the place. So talk to us a little bit about that.
Well, I think, you know, I didn't want to do a history of the bureaucratic institutionalization of healthcare. I think that wasn't really where I was going, but I wanted to, what were the motivations for these amazing innovations and provision of local healthcare? I became interested in there's another link here that I was interested in social Darwinism and those kinds of issues of how those ideas fed into the provision, the construction of healthcare regimes, because that was also true in Canada, that some of the initial inspirations for instituting a national healthcare system came from social Darwinian ideas from people like Tommy Douglas, who wrote an MA thesis on eugenics. So these things, in some sense, were linked at some of the origins of these things. And I was sort of a little torn because I believe in universal health care, but saw these links and wanted to work them through. So in Germany, if you look at these things, the issues are impossible to unintertwine, to de-link from issues of social Darwinism and really the idea of improving the health of the race. Now, if you look at that and how it's actually implemented, and this is what I was interested in, I wanted to find a sort of almost Alltagsgeschichte, history of the everyday way of looking at this. How do people actually react? How do people feel about the kinds of healthcare options that are available to them? So the links all are complicated, but they're really important, I think, in understanding what's going on at that time. For most people, access to healthcare, one of the first ways that became important was access to birth control and preventions of venereal disease and those kinds of things. So that, combined with my understanding that fears about the birth rate in the late 19th and early 20th century were critically responsible for an interest in establishing healthcare that reached everybody, not just certain classes of people, made me interested in Bevölkerungspolitik and population policy. And I really, when I started my dissertation research, that's what I wanted to do. And then I needed to find specific sites of that.
Yeah, and certainly one of the things that I think is so interesting about the book is, you know, we do, because it's a local study, we do get much more of a sense of the everyday. Of course, we often think about things like eugenics and population policy as being great sort of grand master plans. But of course, these things have to be implemented at the local level, and you know, individuals, their point of contact, whether it's a state-run system or whether it's individual physicians or an individual healthcare system, it is very much at the local level. So you opted for the study of Berlin and really what's mm-hmm. happening kind of on the street. But obviously in this context of national concern about the, like you say, the falling health rate, the falling birth rate. So I guess we've kind of gone ahead and made the leap into talking about your book. So yeah, tell us what's happening. What's going on? Your book really picks up the story early in the 20th century with the First World War. Tell us what's happening in Germany. Help us to get contextualized here.
Well, I think there had been concerns about the falling birth rate before the war. This was not new. The Germans actually followed the French in those kinds of concerns, and they intensified in the late 19th century. But the war itself just sort of massively increased not just that concern because of the loss of life and the defeat in World War I, but also it had also massively increased the state's involvement in social life generally. So the increase in social welfare programs, the likelihood that the government would help widows and children and all of these things and sort of really intervene in the family in a much more direct way, with nationalistic sort of motivations, but I think also with some demands from below that people actually really believed that they now deserved some of these services because of their contribution to the war effort. So right after the war, there were several kind of healthcare crises that fed right out of the war, venereal disease being, of course, one of them. There had been a massive increase in venereal disease. And really, it changed the disease from one that was well known in cities to one that spread to all parts of the country. So this part of the book is slightly misleading in a way because I focused on Berlin, where it had always been a problem. But the concern was much bigger than that, because these demobilizing soldiers who'd been exposed to venereal disease, many of them through military brothels and that kind of thing, there was really a sense of an increase, of a massive increase, not just in numbers, but also into how it had spread to other parts of the population where it wasn't common before. And so there was a great concern about that, and really venereal disease at the time was a concern because of its actual consequences, but also because it caused infertility. So this fed into these fears of the falling birth rate. So there's that. At the same time, there were a lot of social concerns about families and endemic diseases in families and families that were very poor having children, and when they possibly were just causing more grief for themselves through various kinds of genetic and endemic illnesses. I mean, really, a really key term here at the time was Volkskrankheit, the people's illness, illnesses that were chronic and endemic in the population that needed to somehow be solved through social means. So there's a fear of contagious diseases like venereal disease, but there's also a huge concern that there were various kinds of endemic diseases in the population, and particularly in urban populations, that needed to be rooted out through very conscious preventive measures and social concerns.
What were some of those diseases? Just give us a couple examples.
Like alcoholism, tuberculosis.
Alcoholism, tuberculosis, uh-huh.
Yeah. So these were considered, I mean, really, in some sense, if you really wanted to write a book just about Bevölkerungspolitik, you would put these endemic diseases in a long list. Venereal disease, mm-hmm. tuberculosis, alcoholism, and then other, you know, sort of other diseases that were difficult to cure. That it was really felt that the whole health of the nation was being weakened in an endemic and really socially constructed way. So you have the rise of whole medical disciplines called, you know, things like social pathology and social hygiene that were really focused on not simply curing individual diseases but working on it from the perspective of a large social understanding how one needed to understand the root causes and the social reasons for these things and educate people about not exposing themselves and those kinds of things. So in that sense, there were all kinds of new access to health for a lot of people. And you have to keep in mind that in the German system, there was insurance for most workers, so they had access to this kind of healthcare. And people like Alfred Grotian and others were really theorizing that it wasn't just about curing disease; it was about training people in healthy behavior, and making sure they made the right choices for maintaining not just their own individual health, but, you know, the focus was really across the political perspective on the health of the nation, on the health of the people.
Right. And this is, of course, a big running theme through your book, this notion of the health of the nation, the health of the people, and how that intersects with the individual, right? Mm-hmm. And you actually, you know, sort of, you use the phrase of sexual duty, or, you know, Or pose the question of to what extent it's individual citizens' duty to think about the health of the nation when they're making mm-hmm. their own private choices about health, about reproduction, about sexual behavior. Mm-hmm. So how is this articulated? This you know, here you have after the First World War, you know, a very activist state with extensive social programs, in a sense trying to communicate a connection between what they might call individual responsibility and the health of the nation. How are they trying to do that?
Well, I think this is the language used in almost all of the sort of literature. There's many handouts that they give people on venereal disease, for instance, that if you go and get treated for venereal disease, you'll get a Merkblatt, it was called, a small brochure telling you about, you know, what you should do to maintain your own health. But really, you know, the opening lines of this were usually, you know, things like we need to strengthen our general national health, and this is a disease that will threaten the future generations and your family health. So it's not just about your individual sexual choice, but about what that means for, you know, your progeny, your future future children, and that's a nationalistic sort of concern. I mean, I think that it's tricky here because, of course, people had an individual desire also to protect their health, and that's played on. But especially in the rhetoric of these agencies, you know, big government committees on Bevölkerungspolitik, on where they really call themselves Bevölkerungspolitiker, they call themselves population politicians, or political advocates. They made sure to always make this link to that they were viewing this not in terms of making sure that people weren't suffering from the illness, but that the key threat was to future generations. And this is part of, I would say, a kind of quid pro quo, that, you know, these services are being offered to you, but you need to act with not just your own personal health in mind, but with these larger goals of citizenship. And so this is how I eventually came to see these things. And I began, you know, when I first wrote the book, I used the term sexual citizenship instead of just sexual duty, because I really wanted to emphasize that there were two sides to this coin. There was the argument being made: you have a duty to protect your health because it will threaten the nation as a whole. But there were rights associated with that. There was access to care. There was ability to get this information to protect oneself from venereal disease or to have access to birth control. Those kinds of things were things that I think people really did seek. I think that sometimes my sort of focus in this book, and I think this comes from this perspective of being actually quite supportive of universal health care and those kinds of things, was I didn't want to just argue that this was simply a top-down controlling mechanism, that it was something that would only, you know, be a negative force in people's lives. You can't have sex with people. You can't have babies in this circumstance, or you must have them in this circumstance. I think if you look at this local level, I think many working class Berliners who went to these clinics were very happy to get this information about how to prevent venereal disease, or how to protect themselves from it, or how to not have child number 6 when they were already having a hard time feeding the 5 children that they had. So I really wanted to emphasize these two aspects from both perspectives. In one sense, this was a regime that wanted to teach and train the working class into healthy behavior for nationalistic purposes. And there are many, many ways in which this led to social controls. So, you know, social workers would talk to working class women about how it was really a bad idea for them to have child number 6, or that they should not, or to men about not being promiscuous and those kinds of things. So there's certainly aspects of this where this nationalistic rhetoric was an attempt to impose a certain kind of behavior on people. But the other side of this was that people really did want to control their sexual lives as well, and they had access to healthcare services, which were quite new and innovative, and in many cases provided a place of advice and solace and care. So I wanted to emphasize the you know, really the double-edged nature of this, and I think that citizenship in many ways is that. It is both rights and duties. I chose not to use the word citizenship just because it's a word that is being often used in very different ways in other kinds of literature that generally advocates an integration of sexual themes from the perspective of homosexuality and those kinds of things. And I thought that the word citizenship instead of sexual duty might detract from what I was arguing, and I didn't want to argue that it was told that everything about this was good, that, you know, mm-hmm. that there was no sort of nationalistic or even racist connotations to what was going on here, which is clearly the case.
Yeah. You know, when we think about things like population control and health of the nation, you know, we, especially knowing that we're in Germany, and we, you know, of course, many of us would associate this with the Nazi regime, but of course your story starts well before that, and in a political environment where not everybody's a nationalist, right? Berlin is a city with actually a very liberal mm-hmm. Administration. Can you talk to us a little bit about the politics of all of this? What's our sort of cast of characters, and why is this why is this so appealing across the spectrum?
Well, I think that's the really tricky thing to keep in mind, and it's another reason that I framed the argument the way that I did, because I think it's really critical to make sure I understand the range of people involved in these programs in the Weimar Republic. I mean, those who worked and organized VD clinics and many of the marriage counseling clinics were often on the left of the political spectrum. They were SPD advocates. They were people who were very concerned about the health of the working class. Alfred Grotjan, who theorized many of these discussions about how health should be, healthcare measures should be focused at marriage and reproduction and all of these things, was a member of the SPD. There were many people active in marriage counseling but still eugenic marriage counseling, who were on the most progressive side of anything going on in the Weimar Republic. So Magnus Hirschfeld had private marriage counseling clinics in his Institute for Sexual Science, which was advocating full rights for homosexuals and the abolition of Section 175, which criminalized sexual activity between men, and he had also transvestites and all of these people coming to his clinics in the same institute. He had a marriage counseling clinic training individuals in eugenic thought about marriage counseling and reproductive decisions. So you have this whole spectrum of people, and really there's, as Atina Grossman has argued, a kind of eugenics consensus at the time, where eugenic thinking was considered the most progressive kind of social health care. Now, I think that at the core, and this is what I try to point out, that there's still a consensus that reproduction and reproductive decisions and even sexual decisions are somehow linked to national duties. And even across the spectrum, this is considered an important way for people to conceive of what they're doing, that these decisions weren't simply individual decisions. And this is not a right-wing idea, that it was absolutely part of what was going on in the SPD. Of course, they have different attitudes to certain kinds of enforced policies. So when the decision comes up, or when arguments come up about forced sterilization, advocates who are more on the left believe that those decisions should still be voluntary, while on the right of the spectrum, there's more willingness to impose those kinds of decisions on an individual. But I think that it's really critical to understand that the ideas were shared across the spectrum, and even Jewish groups really had very similar kinds of arguments about protecting the health of their own ethnic group, making sure that that people thought in these terms, that it wasn't an individualistic decision about what you did in your sexual and reproductive life.
Yeah. Well, so I think that, one thing that I think, because 20th century Germany and certainly 20th century Berlin is such a wonderful laboratory for this discussion, because, we see a kind of a fledgling democracy in between the wars, and then we see the Nazi regime. And then, of course, we'll want to talk about, you talk about what happens after the wars with Berlin divided. Before we get to these questions of political change, though, and of course, also sort of demographic crisis with yet another war, I think many of our listeners are probably thinking right about now marriage counseling centers.
Right.
We know what venereal disease is, but tell us a little bit about these marriage counseling clinics. That's something that's a little bit unusual here.
Yeah, I think that's really critical to distinguish, because we would think of marriage counseling as a psychological relationship counseling. And that's not at all – well, it wasn't absent, but it wasn't the focus. The focus here, and the way it was advertised in newspapers and the way they tried to attract people to come to these clinics was about reproductive decisions. So you were encouraged to go to marriage counseling clinics before you got married, to discuss compatibility and to make sure that you might not have some sort of chronic illness alcoholism, tuberculosis, venereal disease that you could pass on to your future partner and family and children. So really almost the sole focus of these clinics were those kinds of decisions, eugenic, genetic counseling. Relationships sometimes came into it. I think that those discussions were probably had sometimes. I did interview some welfare workers who'd worked a little bit later. Obviously, the Weimar welfare workers would no longer be alive. And I think even in the most when the clinics were set up for purely medical kinds of discussions, often relationship discussions would come up. But really, the focus here was trying to make people to give them the options, to give them information about birth control, to give them the decisions, but also to make sure that they were thinking correctly, so to say, about what made sense in terms of having children, when to have children, how to space your children, make sure that that women would recover from a pregnancy before having another one, and giving them access to birth control to be able to do that, and also. Marriage counseling and venereal disease were kind of intertwined. So trying to find out if there was a disease that could be passed on to children. So the whole focus was on that. It shifts, as we'll probably talk about after the war, to relationship counseling. But really, right up until the 50s, at least the overarching ethos, the reason why these clinics were funded by the city and by the state, were those kinds of eugenic concerns.
And you're talking a little bit about birth control. What kind of birth control is available at this time? What is being made available through the clinics?
Well, quite a diversity. I mean, probably more than was common, say, in the United States at the time. But we're talking about pessaries, a kind of diaphragms, condoms. More and more, they became cheaper and more affordable for the working class at this time. Sometimes they had, and you can see ads for this in newspapers at the time, different kinds of douches that were actually wall mounted and had some pressure behind them. I think those became a little bit less common later. I think most common in the clinics that were advocated were cervical caps, pessaries, and diaphragms, and those things, of course, had to be fitted by a doctor to get the right size and those kinds of things. So there is really a strong sense too in this whole system of making sure that that access to birth control was kind of medicalized, that doctors would give people the advice of how to do it, people with skills, and it was an effort to prevent people from just ordering things through the newspapers and through mail order boxes and those kinds of things which were happening. So there was an attempt to sort of, you know, a growing industry in birth control devices was actually huge in Germany, as of course you know, with companies like Fromm producing massive numbers of condoms. But the idea was as another reason to attract people to these clinics, to make sure that they were using them correctly under medical supervision and not just, you know, buying them on the open market.
So, the book sort of moves so nicely, sort of, you know, really just takes us through the 20th century. How do we get from the Weimar period to the Nazi period? Clearly, part of a lot of what you're talking about, you know, the notion of the health of the nation, the connection to eugenics and so on, sounds very familiar to people who maybe know a little bit more about Nazi Germany. But something must change.
Sure, there's actually, I think, a pretty big change. I mean, it's not just a name change. In other words, what is formally called previously called marriage counseling now gets called racial and eugenic counseling, or the racial health clinics instead of marriage counseling clinics. There's also a huge personnel change. So many of the people who had been, especially in Berlin, and I mean this would look slightly different in other cities, but especially in Berlin, there had been a huge involvement in all of these projects of SPD, socialist, social democratic, and also Jewish doctors involved in this kind of provision of services. And of course, those people are removed. The clinics are, so the personnel, there's a huge personnel shift, not a complete one. There are many people who go through this entire period and even then continue working in these same fields in the post-war. But for those on the left, and those, and especially feminist organizations who were involved in this, many of them are forcibly removed or removed themselves, and the clinics are renamed. And then you have a much more activist approach. There was an attempt on the part of the Nazis. It was never entirely successful, but the goal was not just to encourage people who might need these services to come, but to gather eugenic information about the entire population. So there's literally a card file started on people. They want to find out the genetic family trees of the entire population and gather all this information. It never entirely succeeds, partly because of a resource issue as things are ramping up in this direction, the war begins, and there's a constant pressure on these services because people are taken out of these clinics and medical services and put into war service. So it's very important to sort of look at what the Nazis intended and what they actually achieved. And if the intent here was rather draconian and really comprehensive. They wanted to gather information about these things, about the entire population. But what actually happens is much more haphazard than that. And I think there's a fair bit of interesting randomness almost in who gets caught up in these services. Now, from the perspective of VD, things change quite a lot as well. I could talk a little bit about that because it looks a little different. There's less of an intertwining in some sense of the two services of marriage counseling and VD control, because the Nazis have a different attitude towards prostitution. They start actually organizing brothels themselves during the war, and using it as a way of motivating soldiers on the front, and prostitution is now looked at less as a social problem and more as something that can be controlled by literally controlling prostitutes themselves directly, and so they actually spend less time thinking about venereal disease as something of a large social problem. They don't count venereal disease illnesses anymore. They just make the assumption that because they're controlling prostitutes, this problem is solved, and there's a lot less discussion of those kinds of things. What else happens in as a transfer?
You know, you talk a little bit about the ways in which, you have this sort of nice phraseology about how to think about racism in this context. And, you know, I think you say that racism needs to be explained in ways that go beyond describing the formation, intensification, right, and explosion of racial hatreds. So clearly, you know, it sounds like what you're trying to do is talk about racism in this sort of sphere of life, which might not be the first place we'd look. This isn't about explosions of racial hatreds, as you say. This is kind of a story of bureaucracy, and again, a story of trying to organize sexual life. But how should we think about this in connection with the Nazis' racial programs?
Right. Thanks for
pointing out. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the things I was trying to emphasize, and I think maybe my desire to explain this does come from even my family background, understanding what it was, why did Germans follow? How could they have accepted these kinds of policies? And I think if you look from this perspective, this family, you know, other people have talked about the valorization of motherhood and those kinds of aspects of it. What was it that made people feel like they belonged in this regime? And I think that these policies, it's important that the Nazis didn't entirely invent them, that they drew on previous precedents of saying, if you have a happy family life and if you make your family choices with the health of the nation in mind, then you're a good German. And these things weren't new to the Nazis, but then of course they brought them. They really intensified this whole feeling of of all of your individual choices are directed towards the health of the nation. So it's this aspect of belonging and inclusion that I wanted to highlight. And I think that often that these policies have been looked at from their very negative eugenic sort of perspective. So we have a book from Gisela Buck on forced sterilization, and that makes sense to us as something that the Nazis did through their racial policy. But we don't often enough view why it was that people could accept this, because in their daily lives, this is part of my argument, many of the services that were racially motivated actually provided services to individuals that they wanted and needed and that made sense to them. So it's not to deny the negative policies that were imposed on others, but I think we also have to understand how was it that people could make moral sense of their daily lives. And, you know, I think others have started to look at the Third Reich from this perspective as well, because Gisela Buch's, Claudia Kunz's book on the Nazi conscience. How is it that people could view most of the things that they did and most of the decisions that they made and think of them as moral when they were so racially motivated? And what I want to say is, if we look at the services, the things that were provided to people, most of them were things that they wanted and needed, and they could therefore bracket out in their minds what was going on to what was being imposed upon the outsiders, the racial minorities and the others, because it made sense for them and it made them feel like good Germans.
So we have a sense of the morality of everyday life, as well as the kind of specific health decisions being made. How do people make moral sense of the world around them?
Mm-hmm.
I think you make an interesting point earlier on that there's sort of the Nazis' tremendous ambitions, but then the fact that the regime doesn't last very long before it gets into a pretty catastrophic war.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not the only reason. You know, there are certain limits to what they're able to do, but of course that becomes, you know, that becomes the limiting factor in the end,
mm-hmm.
that attentions have to be turned to the military effort. And then of course, the Germans lose, and that loss, sort of, as you explained, creates a kind of a collision. On the one hand, there is the moral world, which people have been living, and that world has included benefits to much of the population, things like you say, services they value, and now suddenly they're kind of in this land of rubble and terrible mm-hmm. want and hunger and a complete loss of state services. What happens then? And of course, Berlin is kind of ground zero of a place that looks like a rubble field in the aftermath of the war, the collapse of a moral universe and the collapse of social and medical services. And then all of a sudden, of course, the presence of large masses of foreigners, the Allied occupation. What happens next?
I actually found that probably the most fascinating research that I did, because it's really this moment of amazing rupture and confusion. You know, everything, all of these different threads all come together in this post-war period. There's the clinics, many of them keep operating, as even the marriage counseling clinics, and some of them, you know, in the documents of the local healthcare administrators, they actually say things like, well, you know, we had this eugenic idea about what marriage counseling should be, and we have no reason to give that up, because it's not a typically Nazi idea. Others did this in many other countries. They're still, and, you know, they weren't aware of this necessarily at the time, but there was eugenic sterilization going on in other Western countries, in Canada and Sweden and all of these things. They were totally right to say these things were not necessarily a Nazi idea. At the top level of the city administration, of the healthcare administrators, they thought that things would continue as it always had. But what happens is that the people who come to the clinics are seeking very different things. They're, as you said, it's a city of rubble. Men take along the men come back from war very slowly. Then there's huge family problems, and what you find is a real disconnect between the administrators, the city administrators, and the actual health at the actual marriage counselors, because what they immediately start getting their job satisfaction from relationship counseling and from helping these families put their lives back together, and really the discussions about eugenic decisions and children, all of those things completely take a back seat in this very crisis situation. From the perspective of venereal disease, of course, there's another huge wave of venereal disease infection because of the turmoil, because of the rapes that were a huge problem in Berlin with the Soviet occupation. There was a massive increase in unwanted pregnancies and venereal disease, and so the local health workers are inundated with these problems, with women who don't want to carry out a pregnancy that was caused by a rape from a Russian soldier, and a venereal disease crisis. So there's a need that the ideology doesn't disappear immediately in terms of what marriage counseling should be, but they have to react to the local situation. And it's really obvious that it's a demand from below for services and a rethink in terms of the goals of this healthcare structure. And I really think that in this case there's a reaction to this. There's that eugenic kind of thinking disappears, because it doesn't disappear, but it takes a back seat, and actual practice completely changes and transforms. There's other issues here involved in terms of racial politics. Of course, those things don't disappear entirely, and in fact, the fact that there are so many eventually so many black occupation soldiers in Berlin means that the Germans have to deal with that. So there's, and here, you know, the Americans don't necessarily disagree. There's efforts made to try to prevent sexual relationships between German women and black soldiers. There's concerns about fraternization in general with German women and American soldiers, but there's literally discussions about how to prevent German women from hanging out in front of the barracks of black soldiers, because there's concerns about that kind of racial mixing. I found that period was really quite fascinating, and also especially if you look at how the different occupation regimes handled the situation. The anti-BD posters, for instance, have reveal amazing. You can really see the different perspectives. So the German posters are very carefully about, you know, making sure that German women make the right choices about with whom to sleep and how, whereas the American posters are all about avoiding the dangerous German women where venereal disease lurks and those kinds of things. There's a real transitional period there. The idea of sexual duty doesn't entirely go away, but for a while it's completely conflated with this sense of absolute crisis and destruction, the destruction of the family, the dangers of fraternization with foreigners, and all of those kinds of things. And there's some there's this one I think really interesting report written by an East German, in this case from Eastern Berlin, about this situation where they really the healthcare officials really sort of feel like this, that there's this explosion of eros, this explosion of sexual activity that needs to somehow be put back in the box, and then we could get into the differences between how these issues are dealt with in East and West Berlin, which is one of the reasons that I picked Berlin as a case study, to be able to look at all of these different threads and to look at the comparison.
Right. And, you know, and I think this is you know, a terrific transition, right? Because we have this sort of environment of kind of material crisis, right? Where, you know, families are, you know, just having trouble getting back together, having trouble feeding their kids. Perhaps they're homeless. Perhaps the family is not able to reassemble itself. The man is just gone or who knows what, or they've experienced rapes. And at the same time, you have this kind of crisis on the ground. You've got the political division of the city of Berlin and the creation of two city administrations in mm-hmm. a way that are, of course, allied. You know, here we have sort of the municipal level Cold War, right? Mm-hmm. And we see these municipal services becoming embedded into East Germany, meaning the larger communist world, and mm-hmm. West Berlin meaning, in a sense, the larger Western world. And maybe you could talk to us a little bit about what that looks like.
It's fairly difficult. I mean, at first, there's cooperation, right? There's one venereal disease agency that was actually in the east part of the city that actually controls all of these things. The decisions are made in Berlin in the control council. There's cooperation. In fact, in terms of venereal disease, the initial orders on how this was to be handled all came from the Soviet side of things and were Soviet orders directly. And in some sense, the Allies initially agreed on how this should be handled, but as things start separating, and the municipal administration really separates into two sections, then there's debates back and forth, and there's concern, for instance, about prostitutes escaping venereal disease controls because they're moving back and forth across the east-west border. So there's tensions that start evolving in this direction because of the division. It also then becomes very complicated with currency reform and with the fact that in the West there's far more access to penicillin than there was in the East, because they couldn't produce it fast enough and couldn't and weren't buying it from the Americans, whereas in the West it came from the Americans. So there's reasons why the systems separate, and because of the lack of access to penicillin in the East, the controls, the sort of raids and the effort to control individual behaviors continue much longer. So there was this whole phase in the whole city where police and welfare workers together would go into suspicious bars and cafes and just round everybody up and forcibly treat them, forcibly test them for venereal disease, and then forcibly treat them afterwards. And those kinds of really sort of draconian measures decrease once penicillin is available, and once it's made clear that it cures both syphilis and gonorrhea, and then it seems less necessary. People are going to go get that treatment. There is a huge black market in penicillin across the city, and this continues in the East, because in the East they can't produce it as much, and then as the city gets more and more divided, the more draconian controls remain in the East for that reason. In terms of marriage counseling, there's less of a distinction, but the rhetoric in the East is more like it stays longer in terms of saying how critical it is to do this. But then the West, the focus on increasing the birth rate, of course, sort of disappears for a while, because there had been a massive influx of people into Eastern Germany, right? All of these Germans fleeing parts of Poland and other occupied parts of Eastern Europe. So in the early years of you know, occupied of the Soviet occupation zone, and even in the early years of the GDR, the biggest concern is integrating a huge influx of people into that part of Germany, and so there's a few noises made by by Ulbricht and others about how we do need to be concerned about growing our population, but it's not as critical a stage. So their marriage counseling clinics are set up, but from a broader perspective, it's really with the building of the wall that changes dramatically, because now, or actually just before the building of the wall, then East Germany starts losing people in dramatic numbers, people fleeing the East and heading into the West, and then the numbers situation changes, and there's more emphasis placed again on the idea that families should have babies and that this should be promoted. And particularly with the construction of the wall, those concerns grow dramatically. Whereas in the West, I think there was a less clear break in some ways with Nazi ideology. So in the East, they simply said very quickly, all of these policies are Nazi. And these laws are gone, but then there was an easier transition to go back towards population political thinking, because they'd made this supposedly clear break with what had gone before. In the West, there was a movement towards making all of these words and these terminologies and these ways of thinking taboo. So Bevölkerungspolitik as a term and as a concept became extremely problematic for many, many years. It was linked to Nazi thinking. You couldn't phrase things in this way for a long time. I don't think it entirely went away, that thinking, but it was reframed and restructured in the context of a democratic state. And there were much more concerns about having any kind of policy statement that could be considered a Nazi policy. So in marriage counseling and in other areas, there was an emphasis placed on relationship counseling. There was more interest and discussion and integration of ideas from the U.S. So Kinsey's thinking and those kinds of things, and psychological counseling was discussed in all areas of marriage counseling. And even though I think to make the case that it doesn't disappear immediately, the idea of making an argument saying that your decisions about how many children to have was a sort of national decision, those things fade, and they fade rapidly with the introduction of the birth control pill and penicillin. Those things privatize sexual decisions, at least in rhetoric, and at least for a while. So this is what I talk about, this notion of sexual citizenship and sexual duty disappearing from the language, from the political rhetoric, and really from also the practice. I think that even when I went to go talk to, I was looking for interview partners, for people who had actually been in the marriage counseling and VD control clinics in the time period that I was studying. And I went to go talk to some current marriage counselors in Berlin when I was doing my dissertation research in the 90s. And I asked, you know, when I talked about what marriage counseling was in this earlier time, they had no identification with that anymore. That's not the way they saw themselves. That's not the way they viewed themselves. That feeling of these things being part of some sort of a sense of duty or a sense of nationalistic service had totally disappeared. And so this tracking how this works was part of my goal in those later chapters. I think that what's confusing and what's difficult is that this discussion about birth rates and about strength, and those things certainly haven't disappeared, and they're back on this. They came back on the scene actually really after unification. It's sort of something that I mentioned briefly in my introduction and conclusion. This revival of even the use of the word Bevölkerungspolitik after German unification. And why is that? How can that term reappear? And that's, you know, this is one of these things that historians do, make these links to the present without entirely investigating what's going on in the present. I think that the notion of sexual citizenship and sexual duty disappeared. I think it's very difficult for politicians to now make those kinds of arguments, to say you should be thinking about how many children you have is a decision that you should be thinking about in terms of your citizenship, your identity as a German citizen. I think those kinds of arguments are gone, and they've been replaced by discussions about economics and economic growth and birth rates in that kind of sense. And the reason I'm hesitating here is I think this book by Tsaritsyn about population policy, which I have not yet read but which I plan to read soon, is reviving this kind of language without making it clear the links to its heritage over the course of the 20th century.
Which is one of the interesting things about really taking the long view, that, you know, you sort of are able to, you know, you sort of look at the at current discussions and have some sense of what some of the legacy is, even if current actors, you know, aren't thinking in exactly those terms. Mm-hmm. But it sounds to me like you're in a sense telling a story of, you know, this very you know, present moment accepted, where you really are telling a story of significant ideological change, right? For a good chunk of the 20th century, as a citizen, you were supposed to be thinking about your sexual and reproductive behavior in terms of the health of the nation. And this is this is true whether we're in the Weimar Republic or the Nazi period or the early post-war period. But you describe a story in which that really genuinely does change, but maybe not so much as a response to, let's say, Cold War ideologies. But at least from the story you just told, you know, part of it is. Simply a change in the ways healthcare is delivered and what's possible technologically. You know, if penicillin becomes available and this makes it certainly much more pleasant to get treatment for sexually transmitted disease. So you might do that in your own interest rather than undergoing a terribly painful and dangerous cure because it's your duty to the nation. You know, again, the birth control pill. I think this notion of sort of the privatization of reproductive health and its connection to the ability to control one's fertility more in private, right? Which is what the pill enables, seems to be an important part of the story.
Yeah, I think actually, you know, I could be accused of being a little pie in the sky, everything got better. But I find it difficult not to be that way in this story. I think that it did require those technological innovations for it to be possible for people to say, you know, these things are my choice. They have nothing to do with my citizenship, with my service to a state, and really it's very hard not to see this when you track this change over a long period of time, that it did make a big difference, that syphilis and gonorrhea could now be cured with, I think it's like a 10-day course of penicillin instead of a long, month-long process of basically a kind of chemotherapy with Salvarsan and other sort of mercury-based treatments that were kind of chemotherapy. In other words, kill the disease just before you kill the person. Kind of, they were very unpleasant illnesses that required constant attention from the doctor and took a long time to cure. And there really is a massive change when that fear is no longer there. There's an interesting one interesting component of the change, which is why it was so fascinating to look at the transition and the interaction between the occupation forces and the Germans. There was one case where the Germans were resistant. The German doctors were resistant to using penicillin, and a report from the Americans said something like, you know, they prefer to have this control over people. You know, they wanted to put people in the hospital permanently, you know, while they were being treated by penicillin. So I think there was a moment where it was difficult to relinquish and to say, no, we really have to put this medicine in the hands of individuals and allow them to treat themselves, kind of, or give them this opening. I think there there was a moment there that that it was really clear that this meant the freedom of the individual to a much larger extent than some of these German physicians trained in the Third Reich were really willing to give, you know. But there's no question that the access to these things makes the arguments about insisting on people viewing things this way really quite untenable. And so it's hard not to see this as kind of a good news story that when these decisions are individualized, you know, people are happier. There's less pain and suffering, and there's less kinds of social control mechanisms possible. And I really think that we've by now internalized that we would be furious with certain kinds of arguments about sexual activity. Now, the complicating factor here, which we haven't mentioned, of course, is AIDS, which I don't discuss in detail in the book because it's past the chronology. But even if we look at that, there's, you know, you can see a sort of similar transition. The first phases of that disease sort of imposing a lot of moral and sometimes healthcare restrictions on people, and as the treatments improve and as things get better, it retreats as that kind of social control issue. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. So I do think, you know, it is very interesting, right? We come back to some similar questions about what are the intersections between a personal right to health, an individual right, individual access to health, and the role that plays in the larger social good. It's a very, very interesting story. We've taken up a lot of your time, and I'd like to ask where you're headed now. What are you working on now?
Well, I moved. I didn't expect to move in this direction, but as I was doing the research for this book, a specific topic, a specific agency came up that I dismissed and very quickly and figured out I didn't need to deal with, and then later became very interested in. And that's a program that was planned by Heinrich Himmler and the SS called Lebensborn. And what he did was establish a network of maternity homes for – the motivation here was mostly for single women, pregnant single women, with the idea that if they – had a place to go to have their babies and even keep their pregnancies secret, they wouldn't abort their babies. So his goal, his idea, his concern was that a lot of babies conceived out of wedlock were being aborted, and that meant that valuable Aryan, I'm putting that word in quotation marks, children were being lost to the Reich. And so he set up this set system of maternity homes. And the reason that I dismissed it as part of this first book is because it didn't really have anything to do with fertility. My focus on in this book, Politics of Fertility, was on basically any measures before conception. That's the way that I sort of divided up my topic. And when I realized that myths about Lebensborn, that the idea that they were a breeding farm, that Himmler, and this is a large myth that has been perpetuated in popular culture all across the Western world, that Himmler had actually set up these institutions where he would match up girls and SS soldiers to produce a new baby. And if that had been what Lebensborn was, then it would have been part of this book, because it would have been an effort to increase the birth rate. In fact, it was an effort to prevent abortion. But what I'm interested in is not just what actually occurred, which I think is still quite fascinating and really part of the kinds of things that I was talking about, the part of providing services to people who were in dire need and integrating them into the Volksgemeinschaft, into the national community, because that's part of what happened in Lebensborn. But I'm also particularly interested in the myths about it afterwards. I think it's very a logical thought that Himmler would have wanted to breed the master race by actually, you know, sort of artificially putting couples together. And in fact, in some sense, that is what he wanted for the future. But I think there's also an interesting story to be told about why Lebensborn has been perpetuated as this idea of the breeding farm in popular culture, not just in Germany, but across the Western world. And it has also interesting aspects of how we view the Nazis as this sexually seductive force. So I'm looking at what actually occurred in these homes, but also the popularization and sexualization of these themes in popular culture. So I also am looking at novels and porn films and all of these kinds of things, how these myths about the Third Reich get spread.
Very, very interesting. And certainly look forward to reading and learning more about that project. Thanks so much for being with us today. We've been talking about the politics of fertility in 20th century Berlin with author Annette Timm. And it's been wonderful to speak to you. And I recommend everybody run out and read the book.
Thank you.
All right. Our guest today has been Annette Timm, author of The Politics of Fertility in 20th Century Berlin, Cambridge University Press, 2010, and Associate Professor of History at the University of Calgary. I'm Lisa Heineman, co-host of New Books in Gender Sexuality Studies. Thanks for listening.